Well, hey, you know, as Eric said, that song really does talk about some of the ups and downs, the memories, the thinking back to things that actually shape the lives that we live today, the kind of the brokenness that we live in. And so we're going to be looking today at some of these things, some of the things that shape us, some of the shifts we have to make as we continue to think about what it means to propel the next generation to do greater things than us. And we're in week 5 today of this series. If you've missed a week, you can go to our website, crosspointweb.org/podcast. You can catch up and kind of catch up with where we are. My name's Kurt, by the way. It's great to have you here today. You guys excited to be here today? Anybody excited? Yeah. All right, good. I wasn't sure if you were awake earlier, and I think you are now. If it's your first time with us, man, we're just so excited you've chosen to join us today. We realize there's tons of places that you could be today. And during this series, we've been saying often that, you know, even if you're not really into Jesus and you're just kind of checking church out, or you're not really into church and, you know, you got drug here or for whatever reason you're here, I think we can all agree that you know, helping the next generation win is something we can all rally around. And so just out of curiosity, I've asked this a few times during this series, but just to give me a little context today, how many of us have infants in our home? Let me just see the hands of those who have, you know, infants. All right, awesome. How about toddlers, preschoolers? Oh, man, you guys need an extra cup of coffee. I can just see this is why you're so tired. How about elementary students and tweeners, 11, 12-year-olds? Yeah, all right. How about junior, senior high students in the home? As I've been saying, you probably drink a lot right now. It's part of, you know, getting through. You're going to make it. I'm going to make it. Convince me I'm going to make it. I've got teenagers. Anybody with adult children that are out of the home? Awesome. Awesome. And just to kind of set, you know, the context for how this connects to all of us, does anybody know anyone that's younger than them? All of you, all right. You know, so this is why this is so important, because it doesn't matter if you're a parent or an employee or, you know, you're a coach or a mentor, regardless of what stage in life you're in, you have the eye of the next generation. And so we've been talking these last few weeks about how important it is to be intentional in our mentoring and building of this next generation, so we are building ready adults. And the Bible actually has a lot to say on this. I'm going to give you a number of scriptures throughout the morning, and this is one that you may not have known this was in the Bible. You may have thought this came from something else. I'm going to read it to you from the King James Version, which we read from very rarely here, but you probably heard it this way. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train a child in the way he should go," and then there's a promise that follows this. It says, "And when he is old, he or she is old, they will not depart from it." And I love the way the message says it. It says, point your kids in the right direction. They're like rockets, right? You're building a rocket right now. Point your kids in the right direction, and when they are old, they won't be lost. And so, you know, this just, you know, shows us that we have this enormous responsibility to help this next generation, you know, kind of be propelled and equipped to do greater things. And so today, we're going to be looking again at some research from a guy by the name of Dr. Tim Elmore. He's put out like 32 books or something like this. I just stumbled upon him a couple months ago as I was beginning to dig deeper into understanding the next generation. And I've kind of found that this guy is kind of the go-to guy when it comes to understanding the next generation. In fact, Major League Baseball, NFL, NBA, numerous, you know, collegiate sports offices are using him to help them understand how to better prepare and coach the athletes that are coming into their organizations. And so today we're going to be looking at some discoveries that he has been making through his book, and he's revealed in his book 12 huge parenting mistakes you can avoid. And even if you're not a parent, these are things that we must understand. If you coach or mentor or you on-ramp people at the office that are a part of the younger generations, it's important to understand some of the things he's been discovering. And so in this book, he basically says that whenever we see challenges with middle school students, high school students, college students, even young employees in our offices, usually the needle is focused on one of two extremes that is present. And they're polar opposites. He said either there is an abandonment issue that has been going on, or there's an abundance issue that's been going on. Either the adults in their lives were doing, you know, too little for them, and so they're having to figure it out totally on their own, or the adults in their lives were doing way too much for them. And we're really going to focus on that side today, because that's typically what's happening in this culture that we live in of abundance. I first kind of got tipped off on this about 20 years ago, and I didn't know it at the time, but I was having coffee with a friend of mine, Dr. Jose Velasquez. He was the chair of the foreign language department at Anderson University, and I was a youth and college pastor at the time up in Anderson, and Jose and I had become friends, and we had coffee once a week, and we just connected on life, but we'd also talk about, you know, he was teaching college students, I was doing ministry with college students, and I'll never forget the day where he walked into the coffee shop. He just looked kind of defeated. He sat down. He said, "Kerr, I had something happen this morning that I've never had happen in my 15 years of teaching at the college level." And he said, you know, basically it was early in the semester, I don't know, a few weeks in, they just had their first exam earlier that week, and he gave the exams back to his students that day. It was a freshman, you know, intro to Spanish class, and he said there was this girl in the class that was just totally distraught over the grade that she got, apparently. And I'm like, dude, I totally get it. I bombed my first, you know, college exam. He said, no, it's not like you, Kurt. You were like, I was like a solid 2.5 student, all right? So that was like a normal thing. He said, no, this girl, like, she's never got anything less than an A. And I think she had like a C minus or something on this first test. She just like was distraught, ran out of the room. He went to the door to see where she went. She was gone. All right, and he didn't know what was going on. You know, he finished class and, you know, a few minutes later went back to his office, walks into his office. His secretary says, "The girl who left your class, her mom's on the phone. She wants to talk to you." And he said, "Kurt, in 15 years, I've never had a parent, you know, try to talk to me about their kids' grades." And she was basically trying to negotiate like a B out of a C minus for her daughter. And I'm, of course, dying like a thousand deaths for the girl, right? I'm like, oh, my word, how embarrassing if, like, you know, to have your mom call at the college level to, you know, work on your grades. Well, I think what was most alarming wasn't that that happened, but over the course of that semester, three different times he reported that he had parents call trying to negotiate something with their kids' grades that year. And that was kind of a turn point, I think, in our cultures, right around 1998, 1999, around, you know, 18, 19, 20 years ago. And it's well documented today across, you know, the university level, you know, that parents are doing this, you know, by and large. And of course, you sit here and you go, what are they thinking? Well, let me tell you what they're thinking. They're just thinking that they're helping their kids. All right, these like expressions are very, very well intentioned. I mean, this is just a mom and a dad are trying to help their little girl or help their son. And here's the thing though, if the mom and dad keep doing this, then that girl is going to need, you know, a problem solver when she's 25. She's going to need a problem solver when she's 35, when she's 40. And it's what she needs is somebody around her saying, "Hey, you can do this. I mean, you can advocate for yourself. You can, you know, you're going to have to figure out how to work through this on your own, but we rush in and we take care of it. We solve it for them." This is the abundance mentality that Elmore's talking about right here. And we create these outages. So in his book, 12 Huge Mistakes Parents Can Avoid, I don't have time to go over all of them today, but I want to kind of give you a 50,000-foot view. And what's fascinating about these is he says these are happening from New York City to Singapore, from Germany to France. I mean, in every and all industrialized countries of the world, we're seeing these same trends among the next generations. And so he says they basically fall under four umbrellas, these 12 big mistakes. And you can get the book if you want to read them. They're very fascinating. But I'm going to give you these four kind of umbrellas that each of these fall under. And you can cringe if you want when you see them. You can write him a hate email instead of me because I'm just reporting to you what he says. All right. But here's what they are. He says, "We risk too little. We rescue too quickly, we rave too easily, and we reward too frequently." So the 12 big mistakes all fall under these four things. And certainly not in every kid, in every case, are these things happening. But if you're an intentional parent, if you're somebody who's got your kids in, you know, youth sports and going to piano lessons and swim lessons, and, you know, you've got them programmed, or you're a boss trying to on-ramp your employee and you're very intentional about it, or you're a mentor or a coach and you're constantly trying to build, he says these are four things we've got to be aware of. So we risk too little. Let me give you a little synopsis on each one. You know, we grew up, if you are not the youngest generation, then you grew up in a generation where you grew up with a lot of fear put into you. You saw, like, kids' milk cartons at the breakfast, you know, faces on milk cartons at the breakfast table. Remember that? Oh, my word, somebody took that kid, and he's all over milk cartons today. You know, you stuck, like, baby on board signs in the back of your car, so everybody knew, you know, put a bubble around my car. We've taken recently the monkey bars off of our playgrounds, right? I mean, you know, because kids might fall, God forbid, they might break an arm. I thought that was just a part of being a kid. And what's happening is all these things are well-intentioned, right? It's out of good intentions at the core that we do these things. But let's talk about the monkey bars for a moment. All right, you've probably been to a monkey bar, a playground recently where they had no monkey bars, no high slides, you know, that kids could like have to navigate if they're going to really go to the top or not. It's like everything's just, you know, mundane and normal, right? Well, here's what psychologists were beginning to find. They've started publishing articles on this. When the monkey bars started getting taken off the playgrounds, they said, "Mom and Dad, wait, don't move so fast on this. Do you understand that the problem-solving skills that kids need to navigate whether they're going to take the risk on the monkey bars, to problem-solve on the monkey bars, these are the same skills they're going to need in their 20s to move out of your house." Did you hear that? These are the skills they're going to need to like not live with you anymore. In fact, here's how one New York Times article put it. It said, while some psychologists and many parents have worried that a child who suffered a bad fall would develop a fear of heights, studies have shown the opposite pattern. A child who's hurt in a fall before the age of 9 is less likely to have a fear of heights. By gradually exposing themselves to more and more dangers on the playground, children are using the same habitation techniques developed by therapists to help adults conquer phobias. This is where kids figure out and navigate, you know, how much risk can I take? Can I do this? It builds confidence. And these are well-intentioned decisions, right? I mean, we have to think about the consequences. I mean, you know, as these kids like eventually ask somebody to marry them, or they have to go negotiate a job situation, you know, we're making them happy now, but we're removing all possible failure to where they don't know how to navigate some of the important bare essentials of life. Second one, we rescue too quickly. Far too often, you know, our rescuing is well-intentioned, right? I mean, but we have to think about the long-term impact of our rescuing. For instance, you know, a child forgets his backpack or his iPad or her gym shoes or permission slip, and what do? We rush it to the school, right? I mean, I've been guilty of this. I mean, instead of saying, "Hey, sweetheart, listen, you forgot this today, and I know you need it, but you're going to need to problem solve how to get through your day and navigate this. That's just a part of life. You're going to need to use this skill for the rest of your life." And I tell you what, I've been guilty of, you know, running, you know, a lunch to school because my kids forgot it, or putting lunch money. They call me, "Dad, I don't have any lunch money. Put it in the account." And I go online or running, you know, gym shoes or whatever. But I've recognized this is not good, and I've made adjustments over the last few years. In fact, just last week, I took my youngest two daughters down our street to the bus stop. I got home. I put my computer in my bag. I was getting ready to walk out the door. I saw one of their iPads sitting on the couch. And I thought, "Oh gosh, here we go. You know, I got a decision to make right here." And I knew the reason it was sitting on the couch is she had gotten online to see if they were doing I-step testing that day. And so I thought, "Man, if they're doing I-step, I'm going to probably take it in because I know how important that is. But if not, I'm not going to take it." So I text the teacher, "Hey, you guys doing I-step testing? You know, Maggie forgot her iPad." And she said, "No, we're not testing today, but go ahead and bring it in. We're going to use it all day." And I said, "Well, you know," I texted back. I said, "You know, it sounds weird, but I'm not going to bring it today. You're going to just tell her that she's going to need to problem solve and work through her day, you know, without it. And if she has to take a hit on an assignment that she can't get done, we totally understand. This would be a great learning moment." And she just sends me a thumbs up, which the thumbs up, I'm like, does that mean okay? Or you're a loser dad? But okay, you know, I don't know. But see, I think that's being a good parent right there. I don't know if the teacher thought that, but this is where kids grow, when they have to work it out. This is life. We rave too easily. This one basically is we are a generation who's committed to the self-esteem of our kids, right? And I think it's a great thing. In fact, I couldn't agree more with building into our kids today. I try to do this with my kids. I mean, one of my favorite lines is what gets celebrated gets repeated. You know, when you build into your kids or, you know, your employee that's on-ramping, I mean, those behaviors get repeated. So nothing wrong with, you know, building, you know, the self-esteem of our children today. But see, here's where we derail a bit. We take this a bit too far. Because self-esteem doesn't get developed by just being like, "Hey, you're awesome. You're so awesome. Everybody's awesome," all the time. I mean, there's got to be like something to it, right? So self-esteem gets built when there's affirmation and achievement, not just the affirmation part. There's got to be some achievement to it. You may recall seeing an article a few years ago about this Massachusetts high school principal who actually canceled honors night for the high school graduating class, because of the fear of the average kid who may feel left out even though he worked really, really hard. And he took a lot of flack from parents. Think about what this does long term, right? We don't want anybody to feel guilty or feel bad or, I didn't get an A or, I worked hard. Listen, that was my whole life, all right? And if you notice, most of the A students are working for the C students today. Have you ever noticed that? I mean, I was a C student. I got a lot of A students on my team here. They are like rock stars in the classroom. But see, here's the problem with the long term decision of something like this. See, these young teens begin to be communicated. They expect life to be fair, right? I mean, if everybody can't get something, then nobody should get it. That's not how life works. That's not how employment, right? My kids, they're in teams at school working on projects, and they'll come home and be like, so-and-so didn't work at all. I'm like, get used to it. You're going to deal with that the rest of your life. You're going to have somebody on your team who doesn't pull their weight. The other thing it does is it removes the need for students today to learn to deal with loss, right? No one was recognized as excellent. I mean, if I'm not recognized as excellent, then I've got to deal with, okay, if I really want that, how do I go after that? I have to learn that I'm not always going to be in the spotlight because life's not that way. I remember my oldest daughter's very first band concert. Have you ever been to a first band concert? Like they play pretty much the same songs at every concert, like Mary Had a Little Lamb, Ode to Joy. It's like squeaky, and it's bad because you've been in their home while they've been practicing, right? But now there's like 120 of them playing together. And so I just remember being at that first concert, and we got to the end of the concert, and there's like a slow trickle of applause that began, And we were wanting to affirm, the kids, and nothing wrong with that, but what came next I wasn't prepared for. So all of a sudden, people began to stand and gave it a standing ovation. And my mom, who was at the concert, who sometimes says things that she doesn't think through, it just comes out. She was sitting down and she said, "Really? Are we really standing for this?" I was like, "Oh my word, this is like your granddaughter's first concert." But then I was like, you know what? She's right. Like, sure, let's affirm them, but the standing ovation's probably a little far, right? We rave too easily. We rave too easily. Last one, we reward too frequently. It's not just the trophies that we give. It's the participation. Hey, everybody participated, right? It's no keeping score. Everything ends in a tie. I mean, it's this mentality, which probably works when you're like 4 or 5, right? But probably not by the time you're like 8 or 9 or 10, as we see in this great scene from How I Met Your Mother. Take a look.
Great job, guys. At least we're not keeping score, right? No idea what the score is. Could be 53-0. Could be some other score. It's 53-0.
What are we doing wrong, Coach?
You know what? You're not doing anything wrong. It's great that you guys are losing, because in life, it doesn't matter how much effort you put in or how hard you try, people will just give you things, like diplomas and jobs and promotions, so it doesn't matter what you do out there as long as you have fun.
At that point, because they didn't want to fight in front of the kids, your Uncle Marshall and Aunt Lily had one of their telepathic conversations.
Don't you give me that look.
Lily, I can't take it anymore. Your way of coaching is crazy.
Stop yelling at me.
Sorry. But can I please do it my way?
Fine. But I'm going to do it my way, too. I'm getting my guitar.
I don't know if it was Marshall's tough attitude, Lily's gentle encouragement, or some magical combination of the two, but in the second half of that game, that ragtag group of little firecrackers got beat down even worse. In fact, according to your Uncle Marshall, in the second half, the other team got even taller. And one of them turned into a teen wolf.
Kenny, there is a teen wolf on the court. That can't be legal.
I know the teen wolf looks different, kids, but try to make sure he feels included.
Oh, yeah. not traveling, Kenny. You're killing me. You're absolutely killing me.
Hey, watch it, coach. We'll get a technical.
Oh, Kenny. I'm begging you to give me a technical.
When the final horn mercifully blew, the score was, by Marshall's estimate, 118-0. And even though they didn't win anything, everyone, even the coach, got a participation trophy.
I understand if you don't want it.
I love it. I work so hard, it feels good to be appreciated for my effort.
I know, baby.
Maybe your way is not totally stupid.
Thanks. Your way is totally stupid.
Oh, the good old participation trophy, which never means anything, right? Never means anything. You know, we have to think long term. How is this playing out? Are we preparing the path for the child, or are we preparing the child for the path? Right? That's how it goes, right? You know, we got to think long term. I was recently reading about how some HR executives are getting young employees, and right out of college, they're interviewing them. In fact, one major 100 company, Fortune 100 company, actually reported how they interviewed a candidate, gave her a job offer. She received it and said, thank you, and then said, but before I can take the job, my parents now want to interview you to see if you are fit for me to work for. And the amazing thing was they said this wasn't like an anomaly. They thought it was an anomaly. They said 6 times over the next 2 months this happened. Needless to say, none of those 6 candidates got the job. And guess who blew it? The parents blew it. And I mean, it's crazy. You dig into this very far, you find all kinds of stuff. These numbers are actually a little old. These are from like 2013. So what, four years ago, Wall Street Journal reported 8% of recent college grads brought their parents along to an interview in 2013. A full 3% actually had their parents sit in on their job tryout. I mean, and you're like, how does this happen? Well, let me show you how this happens, all right? The Society for Human Resource Management, they asked, you know, human resources executives last year, how are you seeing this play out? How are parents getting involved in the interview process in your specific businesses? And here's what these HR executives reported. One said the candidate opened his laptop and had his mother Skype in for the interview. Another said one mom knocked on the office door during the interview and asked if she could sit in. Another one said parents have arrived with their child's resume and tried to convince us to hire him or her. Another one said a job seeker was texting his parent the questions I was asking during the interview and waiting for a response. Get out of here. Like, you really think that's going to work? I had one mother call and set up the interview for her son, of course. Why wouldn't you do that if you're negotiating their grades in college, right? Get this one, this blows me away. One father called us pretending he was from the candidate's previous company and offered praise for his son. I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? This is like real stuff, right? And guess what, mom and dad, guess what? This is on us, right? This isn't on these kids. These aren't on these new graduates. This is on those of us who are preparing the next generation. I mean, think about this message. What does it scream? It screams, I'll do this for you. Let me put my cape on. Let me zoom in, take care of everything. And these kids are sitting there going, gosh, I don't know if I have what it takes to get the job done. I don't know if I have what it takes to be able to do an interview on my own because my mom or my dad seem to think they need to be there through the whole process. See, I want my kids like knowing how to do it, you know, when they leave my house, not like needing me to be there the whole time. And so we have to think about, what am I doing, and do I have a longer-term vision for what's taking place here? In fact, Proverbs talks about this. Proverbs 29 talks about when there's no vision, the people get out of control. In fact, put the word kids in there. When there's no vision, the kids get out of control. But whoever obeys instruction is happy. Elmore says we have to have a vision. In fact, he says, the further we can see out, the further we can make decisions by looking out into the future, the better decisions we're going to make for the next generation. Does this decision I'm making right now for my 7-year-old or for my 17-year-old or for my 27-year-old, does it help them down the road? Not just now, but more importantly, does it help them know how to navigate life on their own? And the reason this is so important for us to wrestle through is because in the moment, it feels like the right thing, right? It feels like the loving thing to do. It feels like, you know, oh, this is what I should do because this is me being good intentioned for my kid, but it might not be what's best for their future. In our home, we have four kids. We have a 14-year-old, 13-year-old, 10-year-old, and 7-year-old. Somebody asked me recently, they said, hey, you finally figured out how that works. I'm like, yep. You know, meaning like we didn't know how kids, you know, were made, born kind of thing. I'm like, yeah, we figured that out. We just love having kids. And so, you know, we have four, and it's sometimes easier in our house, like, to just pick up after them, right? I mean, it's sometimes easier to just go put everything away. But the question is it better? I mean, see, sometimes I've discovered I have to learn to live with the mess all around us and be okay with, you know, things having not being in the right place, because if I just take care of it or Julie takes care of it, then we're not helping them down the road. I mean, you know, they have to learn to take care of the dog. They have to learn to pick up their clothes. They have to learn to clean the dishwasher out, because in the long run, they're actually better for it. So Dr. Elmer, he gives 10 shifts, you have to really enunciate it, 10 shifts in his book that he says we have to understand. Now, I don't have time to give all 12 of them to you, but I'm going to give three of them to you, which I kind of feel are the top three that many of these things that are creating outages fall under. And if you want to get the book, I highly recommend it. You know, 12 huge parenting mistakes parents can avoid. It's a great, great read. And I'm going to give you three quick hitters that really will help us think about, okay, here's how we might operate, but we need to make a shift in order to better equip the next generation. So the first one he says, don't think control, think connect. See, whenever things don't go the way we want as adults, what do? We come in and whoosh, we take control of something, right? And so, you know, we want to seize control. We want to govern how our kids work, what their study habits are, what sports they're in, what their schedule looks like. We want to govern everything in their life and have it so jam-packed full that there's no room for anything else to happen. And we know control is a myth, right? I mean, everybody know that, right? The control, you can't control anything. I mean, you know, you just don't have the ability to control things. And so, in fact, studies have shown that parents who actually overprogram their kids actually create rebellion in their kids. Why do you create rebellion? Because kids just want to be kids. They don't want to be controlled. They want to have the freedom to kind of do kid stuff. But see, what we do have is we can have connection with them. All right, we can have connection. We can seek heart connection. We can seek to spend time with them, to really understand what's going on with them. If we feel like we need to control a situation, we need to back up and say, okay, what's really missing here likely is connection. And see, if I begin to foster connection, I may not have control, but you're not going to have control anyway. But what you get when you seek connection is a much deeper influence over that young person's life. In fact, one of my favorite scriptures comes from 1 Thessalonians 2:8. When I used to do student ministry, I share with this our team all the time because this just gives a picture of what our responsibility is as we propel the next generation forward. Paul, he's writing to this church in Thessalonica, this group of young Christians who likely aren't doing everything right. I mean, it'd be easy for him to come in and be like, do this, do that, you know, try to control everything so they quit, you know, screwing up all the time. But instead, he says, but because we loved you so much, we were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives. Not like, go do this, let me control that, let me make sure you have no room for mistakes. He says, no, we came in and we shared our lives with you. See, the heart of what Paul's saying here is that every single one of us, we have influence. And you have influence with the next generation. And what I'm asking you to do as we're going through this series is to leverage your time and your resources and your talents and your experience, not to try to control the next generation, but to have an influence, to own a responsibility in helping guide them and prepare them to greater things. This is why dinner table leadership is so important. Having dinner table leadership, you know, what's dinner table leadership? It's the value of having connection time around the table at dinner. And it's not really about the dinner. I mean, the food is there. You have to eat, right? But the dinner table experience is about connection. In fact, NPR, they reported some research data from Harvard recently. They said kids who have regular family dinners have better grades, better vocabularies, and better behavior. They're less likely to smoke, drink, do drugs, have eating disorders, become depressed, or have sex. You know, it'd be easy to control all these things. Oh, I don't want anything these things to happen, so I need to put all kinds of controls in. They say, no. One of the ways you do that is you foster connection by something as simple as dinner around the table every night. This is huge. Because we can't control behaviors, but what we can control is connection. Second one is don't think rules, think equations. All right, now there's a few rules that are needed, right? I mean, in our home, I don't know, we don't really have any standout, like, oh, this rule and this rule. I mean, there's probably three or four or five, like, don't run in the street when they were younger. That was a good rule, right? You get one shot at that usually. We have like a don't be respectful. If it's illegal, it's probably not a good idea. I mean, those are generally like how we, work. But we all know what equation is, right? An equation is, if you do this, then this is the benefit you get. If you do that, then this is that's the consequence, right? That's an equation. It's like your mortgage, right? Try not paying your mortgage for a month, right? What's the equation? If you don't, then you may not have somewhere to live in a few months. If you do, you get to keep your house. So we need to help our kids think in equations. And see, early on especially, when the stakes are lower, where there's not like a major decision, on the line, and that way you don't have to throw all these thou shalt nots out all the time. Oh man, that was not a good decision right there. So I get your phone for the rest of the week. Well, you can't do that. All right, well, watch me. That was an equation. You do something stupid, I take your phone. You were just playing on the internet instead of completing your homework tonight. Now you're up till 11, all right? I'm turning your data off. You can't do that. All right, let me show you how it's done right here. You have no data for the rest of them. It's an equation. It's helping them understand when I choose to do certain things, there are certain consequences or benefits. A couple weeks ago, we looked at this parenting process, these four stages of parenting, which are nurse to king queen phase to the coaching phase to the friending phase. And basically, if you weren't here, the transition between nurse, where you're just wiping and cleaning and, cleaning poop up all the time, the transition to becoming the boss in the home with your kids is when your toddler usually says this like two-letter word, where they decide to go, no! And as soon as you hear the word no, then you all of a sudden are the king or queen in their life, all right? You're the boss. Your job is to bring reality to their life. And that's so important for that moment to happen. Kids today have got to learn that there's an authority above them that they have to answer to. But that's not the whole king-queen phase. See, one of the things we have to move to, even when we're in the king-queen phase, when our kids are younger, is we have to help them begin to get, through this idea of intrinsic motivation. Intrinsic motivation is where I begin to think through, okay, this is the consequence for this decision. This is the benefit for this decision. I make the decision based on the benefit and the consequence. See, when kids have extrinsic motivation, like externally, I'm doing things because of some external outside force, then that means that they're just following the rules because they know they're going to get in trouble if they don't, right? Well, what happens when you're not around to bring the reality to them? They do whatever they want, right? Because you're not there to enforce the rules. So we have to begin to intrinsically motivate them. In our home, one of the ways this plays out for us, it's one of the many ways, is we have beer and wine in our fridge. And every now and then for dinner, Julie and I have a glass of wine. We'll have maybe a cider or a beer with dinner. And we don't have this rule in our house. We're not going around going, don't drink the beer. No beer. Now, they're under 21, so it's like it's illegal. So, don't be you're not supposed to do that. But like the general message, we're not always saying, don't drink the alcohol. But what we do is we'll talk about how, there's a very appropriate place for alcohol in your life. And then, and the Bible even talks about how there are moments where wine brings cheers, times for celebration. But then we're also really clear on how there are lines that are crossed when there's an over an abundance of alcohol and there's drunkenness. The Bible is really clear on staying away from the line of drunkenness. And so, we have these authentic conversations with our kids on a regular basis as we're having alcohol at dinner. They're not having alcohol. But what we're doing is, I don't worry about whether they're going to get into the alcohol when we're not home. I mean, every now and then I'll look and see if, there's the same number of cans as there was, a while back. But I'm generally not worried about that. You know why? Because we're trying to create intrinsic motivation. It's not like mom and dad aren't home, so let us go at it. We're trying to create a sense of they understand a process for decision-making that happens when they're 7, it happens when they're 17, and it still applies to them when they're 27. See, we have to help our kids think through equations. We have to show them equations. It doesn't mean they're always going to make the right decision, but it equips them for their whole life, not just for that moment. Third one is think lecture, don't think lab. Remember high school? Remember science class? How science class had two parts? There were like parts you liked and parts you didn't, right? There was like lecture and then there was lab. Which was your favorite? Yeah, of course, lab. You know, because I think kids today have a lot of lecture and very little lab. And remember what lab was? Lab was like the place where it was safe to experiment, right? Where I could figure things out. I could check, I could kind of explore, use my talents, gifts, my ideas, my hypothesis. See, we need to give kids the opportunity to try new things. We need to give them safe environments where they can try serving, where they can try using their talents and their gifts, where they can meet people, where they can do things they haven't done before, where they can build things, where they can travel to new places. I mean, every time Julie and I travel, just the two of us, to a new place, guess what? Usually we're like, oh gosh, here we go. The kids are coming back next year because we want them to experience some of the same things and places we've experienced. Even movies, music, all these different forms of music and entertainment, these create discovery and they create discussion. In fact, here at Crosspoint, frequently somebody will ask me, they'll come in and, you know, they can't believe we showed a video or some of the language that was in a song or maybe some of my language that I share. And listen, our goal is to create a learning lab here, all right? In fact, every now and then I'll have somebody come up and say, hey, is this a kid-friendly Sunday at Crosspoint in the venue? I'm like, no, it's never a kid-friendly Sunday in the venue, all right? Kids need to be in kids' environments. For one, they need to be out there because when you have them in here, you're training them to be bored in church. That's what you're doing, right? You think they're super spiritual, they're connecting. They're not. Don't like think they're further down the road than they are. You're training them with this mentality that church is boring. So you need to get them in kids' environments. Those are directed right at them. But secondly, you know, we're gonna dive into content in this room that really get at the core of life, and we're gonna be interpreting things. My goal isn't to create a safe environment in here where you're in this like spiritual bubble without anything coming in. We're gonna deal with real things in life. And I always remind people, my kids sit right here in the front rows every week, 13 and 14 year old. And we use what we talk about in here as avenues for conversation, for shaping and interpreting. Because see, when you lead young people in this way, it helps them begin to own their growth. And why do we do this? Take a look at Proverbs 23. It says, parents rejoice when their children turn out well. And that's what we all want, right? We want our children to turn out well. And take a look at this next line. Wise children become proud parents. So we're not only propelling the next generation, but we're actually propelling future generations. Now, I've just gone through a lot of content. If you're interested in more from Dr. Elmer, you can go to his blog. He's got a blog. It's growingleaders.com/... That never gets old, does it? /blog. And those of you in the younger generations, you're like, what? I don't know who that is. His name's Slash, by the way. That's Slash right there. So as we kind of wrap up, I want you to take out your connection card. On the back are some next steps, and these are really important. Each week, I want us to think through, okay, what are we doing with what we've just heard this morning? And maybe for you, maybe it's your first time with us, and your next step's just returning next weekend. Maybe it's just coming back to join us again, and that'd be awesome. I mean, I tell you what, next weekend's going to be awesome. I know it's Memorial Weekend, but we're going to have a really cool close, and you're going to get a cool walk away next weekend, so I hope you'll be with us. This next one, I'm going to be intentional this week to identify how to better leverage my time and talent and experience. I think a lot of us, we need to give some thought to what do I have to bring to help the next generation be more successful out of everything I've experienced, the mistakes I've made. Maybe God's just revealed a shift to you. Maybe he's put something on your heart this morning, a shift that you need to make this week, whether it's with your kids or your employees or somebody you coach. Didn't really get into serving. We'll talk about this a little more next week. But you realize that serving, living a life of serving, we have all kinds of opportunities for you to get on our team here at Crosspoint. Do you realize this is becoming known as one of the single greatest factors that enable the next generation to excel above the rest of that generation? Is them beginning to embody a heart of serving? And how do they get a heart of serving? They watch you serve. They watch it modeled from your life. So, you want to set your kids up for success, man, get involved somewhere here in the community, giving your life away. I want to say one more thing as we wrap up. My heart's been heavy on this one this week. You know, if you're in a difficult place with your kids, whether they're still in your home or maybe you have adult kids and they just aren't on the path that you hoped they'd be on. My prayer has been this week that God's grace would just wash over your home. That God's grace would wash over your life. I really do believe that God steps in and fills the gaps in our shortcomings. And sometimes there's nothing we can do. Maybe this series has kind of brought up a lot of things where you're just like, man, here's the mistake I made, and there's a mistake I made. That's not the goal at all. And I want you to know that, you know, as Paul says in 2 Corinthians, he says, my grace is enough. It's all you need. My strength comes into its own in your weakness. So if you've had those moments where you've just been like, oh gosh, man, I just blew it right here. Just know that there's a grace that comes, and that hope isn't lost, even when we see the next generation, whether it's our kids or somebody we're coaching, you know, maybe not exactly where we want them to be. We got to trust that God's grace is greater than our weakness. So let's stand. Let me pray for us, and then we're going to sing one more and get out of here. God, I just pray that you would help us to be consumed with equipping the next generation to go beyond us. And God, if we don't have anybody next to us, then I just pray that you show us. I pray that you would help somebody come across our path this week that we can build into, that we can begin to, you know, maybe somebody's just a bit younger than us, that we can begin to share our experiences and leverage our talent, our skills, and what you've shaped in us, that we can build that into the next generation. God, help us to listen more than lecture. Help us to connect more than control. God, help us to see life as a learning lab, to create learning experiences, and give us enough room to fail. God, I just pray that you'd use us, help us to, beginning today, even right now, to make some decisions that will move this next generation forward, because we want to be people who are changing the world. And God, we realize that begins right here with us.